This is a Rough Tiger production.
I'm still writing my story here. This is Dream Idiots. My name is Morris. That's Brian. Each week we tell each other stories and then bring you along for the ride. And you can find us in most places online.
Yes, you can. Yeah, you can find us on every single podcast platform out there, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Podchaser, all the rest. If you can, shoot us a review, give us 5 stars. That helps us somehow. And please like, share, subscribe, post it on Facebook, steal your spouse's phone, and have follow us on their behalf. That'd be great. You can check out dreamidiots.com for our entire back catalog of pushing 200 episodes going back 4 years, all live at dreamidiots.com. And if you have a story idea, a curse word of the week idea, just want to drop a line and say hey, you can go there as well. There's a contact us form on the website, or you can just email us directly at dreamidiotspodcast@gmail, and we're on Instagram and Facebook too a little bit. I need to be doing a better job of posting there, but we appreciate you hanging in there and listening to our weekly therapy session, weekly, I don't know, insanity, I don't
Social diarrhea.
know. Sounds about right.
That was uncalled for. Yes, we take turns going first. Do we have any announcements? I don't think we do. Any
We did not. I have no announcements.
or
No,
updates? Okay.
zero.
So this is episode 160, which means I get to go first. And Brian, I'm going to turn back to a topic that we have not touched in a long, 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 long time. Let's all go to the movies, Brian. Let's all go to the movies 13 for 31, because around this time of year, a lot of folks publish their 31 for 31 lists. Have you seen these?
No, I've not. It just doesn't
Okay,
even ring a bell.
it's a day-to-day calendar, a guide to horror films to be viewed all through the month of October. The idea is that you watch one horror film a day for the entire month. Now, I'm too lazy for 31 lists, so I'm using the best number, 13. It is a prime number, like 31. Which is good. And this is not a definitive list. It's simply my favorites in the genre. And I thought I'd talk about my 13 favorites and tell a little bit about when I remember seeing them. And you might say, what? There's nothing prior to 1973? No. There's only one foreign film? Yes. There's no accounting for my taste. And you know, there's one movie, for example, that everyone thinks should be on here. The movie that made me so sick, just absolutely nauseous and sick to my stomach, I had to leave the theater. 1993's Indecent Proposal, starring Robert Redford, Demi Moore, and Woody Harrelson, is not on the list. See the episode, Movies I Walked Out Of from earlier in the Dream Idiots run. So here we go, Brian. Number 13 on my list from 2024. It's the most recent film on my list, directed by Chris Nash. I think he wrote it too. In a Violent Nature. Have you heard of this film?
No idea. Never heard of it.
Okay. Now, it's a beautifully shot, almost continual point of view from the killer's point of view. And have you ever wondered what it's like brushing through the trees, stalking campers in the Canadian wilderness, right? Or well,
No.
you've probably lived that experience. So, well, now you can. There's long, lingering shots of the beautiful environment, nature. There's some overhead pans that are fantastic. And then you're doing this beautiful overhead shot of a creek, and there's suddenly somebody dragging a body through it. It's really astonishingly well done. And it is a very, and this is a stupid thing to say, but it's a very visual film. It's the kind of thing that you can watch for several minutes and there's absolutely no dialogue. It's really arresting in that sense, and there's nothing else quite like it that I've seen in quite a while. And I'm going to call this a gentle horror film, Brian. It's the kind of horror film that Henry David Thoreau would have watched. It really is fantastic. It's available in quite a few places streaming, I believe. That's how I saw it. I know you're not a big horror film fan, though, are you? You don't
Not
particularly care
really.
for horror. Well, too bad, because you got 12 more to go through. Number 12. From 1979, directed by Stuart Rosenberg. This is the guy who gave us Cool Hand Luke, Brian. The Amityville Horror. You ever seen this?
I did see it at some point as a teenager, I'm sure.
Oh, I got you beat there. I saw this in the theater when I was seven. as established
PTSD, my God.
as established in my movies I saw with my mother episode of Dream Idiots, my mom had a loosey-goosey sense of appropriate movies to take her kid to. I was able
It's 79, you said?
So I was seven
Okay.
going on eight when it came out. I was able to follow the film because, as my elementary school teacher noticed, I had read the book. Expressing concern, she called my mother. My mother responded, "I know, we're seeing the movie this weekend. We can't wait." I remember my older cousins, who are all about 10 years older than I am, my mom's side, reading this book, and each chapter, when you open it up on the book, it says like chapter two, and there'd be a fly printed on the page because flies are a big theme in the movie. And at one point, one of my cousins, I can't remember which one it was, but one of them was, she was reading the book, and as she read the book, a fly came up from behind the book and scared the hell out of her, and she threw it across the room. The film is based on the Lutz family and their haunted house experience out on Long Island in a house that was the site of the infamous DeFeo family murders, where Ronald DeFeo murdered his entire family and blamed it on basically demons in the house. It features the guy who's currently married to Barbara Streisand, Margot Kidder, and the best actor from 1967, Rod Steiger. Murray Hamilton, the mayor from Jaws, is also in it. He plays a priest. It's a great film. It still kind of gives me the willies. It's despite the fact that we all know it's based on Jay Anson's book, which turned out to be complete and total horseshit. But still, it really did rivet the nation there, the book, and then the subsequent movie, and the many, many sequels. But that first one still packs quite a punch, in my opinion. Now, this next was one you'd actually might like, Brian. Have you ever seen Wolfen from 1981, directed by Michael Wadleigh? Wolfen?
No.
Great. This is another film I saw as a kid in the theater, most likely with my mother. It's the story of alleged werewolves terrorizing Manhattan.
Okay.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's kind of based around buildings that are being torn down. Five-time Academy Award nominee Albert Finney is in the lead
Oh,
role.
wow.
Yeah,
Great
and
actor.
so is Gregory Hines, the very talented actor and dancer. There's another Academy Award nominee in the film, Edward James Olmos, in a very early role, just crammed with talent. And if that weren't enough, Brian, Tom Waits has an uncredited role as a bartender. But it really kind of traces the idea of urban blight and urban decay and how these predators move amongst it. It's also switches perspective. Sometimes you see it from the quote wolves' point of view. It's got a strong Native American element into it, which I really like as well, because it ties into the steel workers, the various steel workers and the tribes that built Manhattan, really. These Skywalker guys who went up there and just literally put buildings together. You can also see Gregory Hines's bare ass at one point in the movie. He and Albert Finney are posted up on sentry across the street from each other in different buildings, scanning to look for wolves, watching each other's backs and so forth and fronts. And he looks up, and Gregory Hines is hanging his ass out the window at him, shaking it, and says, "Hey, look, man, Black Moon over Manhattan." It's great. It's a great, great movie. Number 10 on my list. Now, some people will say that this film should not be on the list. Southern Comfort from 1981. You ever seen this, directed by Walter Hill?
No idea.
Oh man. This is a film that shows you what would have happened if things had gone really bad for the guys in Deliverance. Some people, like I said, would say this is not a horror film, but I don't care. It's a scary as shit movie. It was a staple of HBO programming in the 80s, and it tells the story of nine National Guardsmen on maneuvers in the swamps of Louisiana. Any ringing any bells? No.
No
Okay. Things go horribly wrong when they piss off the locals. One by one, the weekend warriors are picked off in brutal fashion. Amongst the cast are Keith Carradine, Peter Coyote, Fred Ward, and Powers Booth. And if that's not enough, the soundtrack is by Ry Cooder.
Right, I have no
The
idea who that is.
guitarist? Oh, wow. Okay. All right. I find that stunning and scary in its own right. Anyway, it's good stuff. Check it out. Southern Comfort from 1981. Brian, have you ever seen Dead Snow from 2009?
Nope.
It's the only foreign film on this list, unless you count In a Violent Nature, which is Canadian. It's directed by a guy named Tommy Wirkola, and we're going to class this up a little bit and get to this foreign comedy horror film. It is friggin' great. It's about a bunch of city folk who travel to the Norwegian countryside to a remote mountain cabin where nothing bad ever happens on Easter holiday. Through their discovery of hidden Nazi gold, they awaken the frozen zombie corpses buried all along the mountain ridges. So, killing zombies, check. Killing Nazis, check. A kick ass fight scene
Okay,
set to,
whatever. Close enough.
okay, Alex Anderson's hit song, Min Dog, My Day. Great. The last 15 minutes of that movie are just fucking fantastic. There was a sequel called Red versus Dead that came along later, but that first one, Dead Snow, is really, really good. And blood looks so pretty on snow. Now I know you've heard of this film because I know you've heard of this director from 2019, Us by Jordan Peele. I know that you've heard of this film.
Right.
Have you seen it?
I have not.
Okay. There's a lot to be said about Jordan Peele's work, particularly in presenting horror from a person of color's perspective, which is a change for most horror films.
Because
And
he's done two or three other horror films, right?
yes, his first big one was
Us, Get Out. Okay.
Get Out, Us, and then Nope was his most recent one.
Okay.
I think he might have another one out, but I don't know if it's a horror film. I haven't seen a movie in the theater in a while. Us is my favorite of the three. It's a story of doppelgangers, nature versus nurture, and Hands Across America. Brian, do you remember Hands Across America from the 1980s? For those of you who don't remember, it was an attempt to do something where America would have one continual chain of people holding hands from coast to coast. It fell apart somewhere in the West because states get really, really, really big out in the West. But Academy Award-winning actress Lupita Nyong'o is in it. She kills it in a dual role. It's a terrific rebuke, really, of the Reagan era. It's a very damning look at the Reagan era. It's very subtle, but it's really great. If you haven't explored the work of Jordan Peele, you really should. Get Out's the first place to start, of course, and then Us and Nope. All three of them are fantastic, but this is the one that I particularly like. Now, you may have heard of this film, Brian. The Exorcist, 1973, directed
Yes.
by Little Billy
This one
Friedkin.
I have seen.
This one you have seen. What do you think of it?
I mean, I saw it, well into adulthood, I think. I may have seen portions of it beforehand. I mean, parts of it are so campy, but it is good, and sort of funny. But yeah, it's a good film.
Wow, funny. Yeah,
Yeah, it's
I'm
just because
big.
of the campiness and the vomiting and her head spinning and stuff. It's like, oh my God. When I saw it, I'm over 25 or 30, and I'm like, this. I recall finding it sort of silly and not scary.
I'm really worried about you, Brian. I had the opportunity to see this in the theater on my 30th birthday. It was re-released, I believe, on Friday the 13th.
Okay.
And that's how I spent, I think, my 30th birthday alone in Salt Lake City in a theater watching The Exorcist re-release on my birthday. It was a great experience. William Friedkin, of course, had a great string of films, French Connection, The Exorcist, Sorcerer, which is another really good one. Friedkin just passed away a while back. Academy Award winner Ellen Burstyn is in this, and Academy Award nominees Max von Sydow and Linda Blair also appear in The Exorcist. Linda Blair was nominated for Best Supporting Actress for her role. And there's not, I'm not saying a lot about these, the ones that are further down the list, because I'm assuming everybody knows them. For example, you have to know number six, Robin Hardy's 1973 English film. Oh, another foreign film, The Wicker Man. I know you've seen The Wicker Man.
I have.
And what's your take on The Wicker Man?
I don't recall that. I mean, definitely spookier, scarier than in my mind than The Exorcist was.
That's why it's further down on my list. It's a reference to the old gods of Celtic mythology, right? And the idea of the harvest. And my current obsession with the heavy metal band Green Lung, I compared Green Lung's work to basically if the Wicker Man and the Demons episodes of Doctor Who were people and had a baby, it would be Green Lung's music. Edward Woodward is in this film. Christopher Lee, Britt Eklund is in it. And the vocal talents of Annie Ross from Lambert, Hicks, and Ross, which I'm sure you recognize as a vocal trio in your time in jazz.
Oh,
They're the ones, Vocalese albums, they're the ones that translated a lot of
okay,
songs
yes.
to,
Oh, yeah,
yeah,
okay. Yeah.
really fantastic voice. She was also in Shortcuts, too, as well, Annie Ross. Wicker Man is the story of a kind of uptight, priggish policeman who goes in search of a missing girl in the Outer Hebrides and finds something very sinister and very nasty in a tiny village on the coast.
And just either last night or night before last, the remake with Nicolas
Oh,
Cage
God.
was on to I so I, as random happenstance, I watched 60 seconds of the remake within in the last 2 days.
It's the kind of remake that makes you grateful for the original. Number five, this is one that I first heard of through one of Patton Oswalt's tweets about it. From 2015, S. Craig Zahler's Bone Tomahawk. Have you heard about this film?
You and I have talked about this
Oh,
film.
have we? Okay.
You have recommended this film to me on more than one occasion, and I believe it's been recommended. I mean, people rave about this thing. I have not seen it, but because I keep getting these glowing reviews, and I guarantee you, because I have every single streaming service, even though I don't really use them, I guarantee I have a way of watching it somehow. It's on Prime or it's on one of them, so I'll make a point of watching that here very, very soon.
It's great. Kurt Russell, Matthew Fox, Patrick Wilson, Richard Jenkins. It is a combination Western horror film, and it is really great. It's about living life out on the edge and what lies beyond what you can see out there in the hills and in the deserts. It is super creepy. There are parts that are super gory. There's one scene, you'll know when it happens, but that it's followed up with a much worse scene not long after that. It's very subtle, and it's, well, I wouldn't call it subtle. It's very underplayed, and it's very like, oh dear God, did I just see what I think I saw? It's just a tremendous film. I can't praise this enough, and it pairs well with another of my favorite horror films set in the American West, one which almost made this list, Ravenous. If you've not seen Ravenous, it's beautifully shot. It's set in the Sierra Nevadas. It's basically about the Wendigo. It features Robert Carlyle, he Digby of Trainspotting fame, David Arquette in a great role, the late John Spencer from West Wing is in it, Jeffrey Jones, who was the principal in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, who we don't really talk about, he's in it, and Neil McDonough's in it, and Guy Pearce is the lead, and it's about a. It's about a bunch of Union soldiers stationed out in the Sierra Nevadas who have to make some really hard decisions. Number four on my list, and this should su surprise no one who knows me, it's one of two films by this director on this list, 1982's The Thing, a remake of a 1950s classic starring Kurt Russell, Keith David,
Russell,
and Wilford Brimley. It was overshadowed at the time by another horror film set about aliens from space, and that film was E.T. E.T., of course, was a box office smash. Thing kind of got lost in the shuffle, and a lot of people didn't like it when it came out, which I can't understand. The Thing has all the wonderful elements of what you need for a good horror film: paranoia, a little bit of gore here, or a lot of gore here and there, and a fantastic cast. It's also got just an incredible ending. It's just probably the best ending of any film on this list, actually. And it's one of a couple films that Kurt Russell, I just mentioned Kurt Russell and Bone Tomahawk, but he really killed it here because the director is John Carpenter from 1982. We'll get into Carpenter in a little bit, some more. I assume you've seen The Thing at some point.
I'm
Oh
ashamed
my
to admit that
God.
I've
Oh
never
my
seen the
God.
thing.
Oh, so good. Number three is going to make people who are in the horror business either love me or hate me, and that's Phantasm from 1979 by Don Coscarelli. Have you ever seen Phantasm? I don't even know why I'm asking you this at this point. I'm guessing you haven't seen Phantasm. If you were to ask me what is Phantasm about, it's about a graveyard and a mortuary and a little shiny ball that drills people's brains out, and there's little dwarves, and there's a fortune-telling blind woman, and there's a kid who lost his parents, and he's struggling to keep what's left of his family, that his older brother, together. And on top of all of that, there's an ice cream salesman named Reggie. Oh, there's also a musical performance halfway through. Phantasm has a weird dreamlike quality to it with its own internal logic and kind of dream world where, oh, of course it makes sense that suddenly you're at this diner. Transitions are really weird in between scenes where someone is suddenly just there. You're like, oh, how did this happen? And it gave us two great horror elements, and that is the shiny flying metal ball, the brain drainer, and Angus Scrim, who played the tall man who runs the mortuary. This also spawned a whole bunch of sequels, all of which are weirder than the next. And it's one of the few horror franchises if there was a marathon on and they were playing all, I think they're up to five, I would sit and watch them all because it's just this bizarre, they don't explain things for you. And if they do, it's usually inaccurate. But you kind of have to make sense of the world as you're thrown into it, which I really like. It doesn't play nice with you. It doesn't play fair, but it's also damn fun too.
Right.
Number two, I know you've heard of this film. I know you've seen it. It's a movie that creeped me out as a kid and still creeps me out today, but God damned, I love it. I love every minute of it. And it was devastating for one of the performers. And that's The Shining from 1980, Stanley Kubrick's what they call cinematic horror masterpiece of the American West. What is the film about? It's about a lot of stuff. If you've read the book it's based on, you know that there's a history of controversy between Stephen King and the filmed version of his book. It's one of the three great Stephen King novels, I think, The Stand, The Shining, and Salem's Lot. I'll start with S. It's got a magnificent performance by Jack Nicholson, a tortured, literally tortured performance. One of the things that makes it hard to watch this film is you know what Shelley Duvall went through in the filming of this, and she was never quite the same afterwards. I mean, Kubrick was a real bastard when it came to stuff like this. And
Yeah, because as I recall, she did The Shining, and then either right before or right after, there's this, and then she was in Popeye with Robin Williams,
Robert Altman film. Yep.
and then, I mean, name one other movie she was in after. I mean, after that, I think her
Yeah.
career was she just like okay, she young, and then at some point later on, I mean, she moved to Texas because she when she passed away, she was living in Blanco or Wimberley or somewhere up there,
Fredericksburg, somewhere out
yeah,
in the hill
so somewhere
country.
out
Yeah.
there, right.
It's The Shining to me is just, and having visited the hotel it's based on, the Stanley Hotel here in Colorado up in Estes Park, it really makes you think about things like, and this has become a trope online, and there's actually a Reddit thread called Accidental Kubrick, but it makes me think a lot about liminal spaces that are transitory in nature. And a hotel is one of the best examples of that. Or in the words of David Lynch, one of David Lynch's characters, I am a house with many souls. Right, that all these kind of things go on behind the doors of hotel rooms that we don't see. And to this day, it still really creeps me out. Not as much as it creeped out, much as it creeped out a cousin of mine who flipped out watching it one night. He was like a second cousin, I think. Anyway, you've seen this film, I guess.
I've seen this The Shining several times. No, I mean, I should go back and watch it again. The famous scene of him using the axe to chop down the bathroom door is sort of is probably the best known scene. But the two scenes that I remember registering, I don't know, the most clearly to me when I first saw it is when he is, he's been locked away typing, 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 and there's the sound of him typing. And then she goes into the huge room where he's been working and looks at his transcript, or looks at what he's been typing, and it's the same, that's that same sentence, all work and no play, over and over and over and over, just hundreds of pages of it. That scene's makes just gets your hair on end. And then the other scene, I'm not even sure why this registers as being so peculiar and creepy. I guess it must be the first scene where Nicholson goes into the bar
Oh
and
yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
starts talking to starts talking to the bartender. There's something about that scene, and thinking about it now, it feels like Kubrick must have been a huge inspiration for Wes Anderson, because stylistically, that scene seems very Wes Anderson-ish to me. Because everything's sort of squared off and framed off, but that whole exchange is just done in, I don't know, the whole thing is just like is very, very cool and very good, but it does just the whole cadence of it is peculiar and off tempo in a weird way that just lands sort of strangely. So
It does,
it's super creepy.
and I have a possible explanation for that because there's a great documentary called Room 237. If you're fa have you seen this?
No, I've not. I've heard of it,
Okay,
yeah.
so basically, for those of you who haven't seen it, it's about eight, nine people's take on what The Shining is really about. And it starts off, and the first one, the guy says, "Well, you know what the film is really about," and he points to all these clues in the visual cues, like the very, it's about the genocide of the Native Americans. And you're like,
what?
okay. But that scene you're talking about is one of the things this guy's points to, because one of the things he's talking about is he says, it's the white man's burden, Lloyd. There's this undercurrent of racism there that is, you know, very in a Rudyard Kipling kind of mode. We must take care of our little brown brothers and sisters kind of, you know, noblesse. What do they call that? Oblige noblesse, right? Where you're because of your status, you're required to do this. That scene kind of turns that whole thing on its head. And then he points to some other clues in there, like the Calumet baking powder and other things that are in the back of the scenes that have Indian motifs in it. But as the film, as the documentary 237 progresses, the theories of what the film is about get more and more just, what the hell are you people on? What are you talking about? So by the time you get back around to the last one, you think, hey, that first guy, the one about the Native American, that one makes kind of sense compared to
that's dead
everything else.
on, right?
Yeah, it's a great film. I bought it. I'll, you know, it's kind of fun to put it on and then watch The Shining. I've done that a couple times, usually around this time of year. It's again one of those films. I did not see this in the theater. This is one of the ones that I snuck and watched on cable when my parents weren't. And of course, I ended up not sleeping for days after seeing this film. So that's The Shining from 1980. Can you guess what number one is, Brian, from 1978?
1978.
Mm-hmm.
The Omen.
No, that was on my list of, and I'm going to throw out a couple here that I didn't put on the list. It's John Carpenter's first installment of Halloween. I went with a very obvious one. Just in terms of like an early film from a filmmaker, it's got such a great rhythm, a great pace. There's actually very little gore in that film. It's all about building up the tension and just doing weird stuff with camera angles and shadows. And it introduced the world to Jamie Lee Curtis. It just has this wonderful small town feel to it, despite the fact it's supposed to be in Illinois. You can see palm trees because it was not filmed in Illinois, it's filmed in California. But it just has this rhythm and pace and look to it. That was so interesting, and I wish I could have seen it in the theater when it came out. Of course, I'd be the old fart now, sitting in the theater with all the teenagers watching it. And on top of all of that, it's got Donald Pleasance in it. I mean, it's great. And when you think about John Carpenter, and that he had a string of films: Halloween, The Thing, Escape from New York, and prior to all those things, Assault on Precinct 13. And you can tell a Carpenter film. When I list my favorite directors, I often leave him off, which is weird because you don't associate films like this with great filmmaking, but goddamn, he put together good stories. I mean, just really incredibly written stuff and directed stuff. And I try to watch Halloween every year on Halloween. I usually have it on when the doorbells ring, so I watch it in bits and pieces, which is kind of interesting because that's what the characters are going through. Their evening is continually interrupted by trick-or-treaters and kids screaming and mass murder, you know, murderers coming in and killing people, but it's just such visually a stunning film. I also like Halloween 2, which I know a lot of people don't like, but to me that wraps up the story perfectly, the way Halloween 2 ends. I do enjoy that movie. There were a few that did not make the list that I threw around. Of course, the original Psycho, the original Night of the Living Dead, Halloween 2. Midsommar and Hereditary, two great modern films. They're not on my list because I need to let those soak in for a while by Ari Aster. They're really great. 30 Days of Night, which tells a terrific story of something that was just so unique, and it was based on the comic book about, you know, what if a bunch of vampires went and took over a town near the Arctic Circle? And that way they could have, you know, darkness all around them all the time. A wonderful film that's a horror film, but it's not a horror film, but it is a horror film about alcoholism, kind of like The Shining. The Wolf of Snow Hollow. If you've not seen this, it's a low budget film. It is really fantastic. Speaking of wolves, the Stephen King adaptation of Silver Bullet. Yeah, I know it's corny, but I love it. I watched a lot as a kid. Wolf Creek, which is about the wonderful world of serial killing in Australia. And I believe this is the case where it's based on true events, and the guy they arrested, when they figured out that he killed this one girl, as they're cuffing him, taking away, his last words to him was, "Did you find a boyfriend yet?" The 1978 version of Invasion of the Body Snatchers with the great Donald Sutherland. Pontypool, which is a wonderful, wonderful film about something that's happening outside. Almost the entire film takes place inside a radio studio in a community radio station, and a person is describing what's going on outside. Very clever, very fun, very smart film, Pontypool. The original Mummy, Omen, Rosemary's Baby, Zodiac, which I think is a horror film, but it's not a horror film in the right kind of way. It's a horror. It's a very much
Right,
a horror
Zodiac
film
Killer,
about,
Gyllenhaal.
yeah. It's really about the horror of obsession is what that film is about. The Hitcher with Rutger Hauer almost made the list, and C. Thomas Howell, Candyman with the great late great Tony Todd, and then I pondered putting Jaws on the list, but I talk about Jaws enough, so I didn't put it on the list. That's a summertime film anyway. So,
Right, okay.
not that it's not horror, and that not that it's not action adventure. So, I hope that this has given someone out there. Obviously, you're not going to watch the 13 for 13 because this is dropping on the 14th. But maybe one or two in there that you haven't seen that you might want to give a view to, because I do like horror movies, and I do like the resurgence they've experienced thanks to folks like Jordan Peele and Ari Aster. It's kind of nice to see the genre people realizing that horror films can be intelligent and smart and
Right.
funny and all these other things. So.
I would add to that, and probably slightly more mainstream, Poltergeist is still a good movie that holds up.
Oh yeah, why did I not? Yeah, I saw that in the theater too. And oh man, when that dude starts picking at his face, looking in the mirror, oh God, that just oh.
It definitely that holds up quite well, I think. Love Craig T and love Joe Beth.
Yeah, and
So
it's
great,
got one of
great.
those old, it's got one of those 70s, 60s, 70s actors in it who plays his boss, who's the creepy guy who admits what ha he's in a ton of stuff. He's great too. Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good, and that has its own horror story behind it with the amount of deaths
Yeah,
associated
those
with that
the three
movie.
children. Yeah, that's yeah. We
Yeah,
could
one of,
do an episode just on that. Awful.
yeah, I think the boy's still alive, but of
No,
course
he's not.
he's dead too. Okay.
They all died forever ago. Yeah, I
Oh, I
well, I
didn't know that. I
think.
thought he was still alive.
I don't think so.
Dominic Dunn was murdered, and Heather O'Rourke had I believe a heart condition. It's terribly sad,
He's right.
but yeah, great film. Absolutely, great, scary, wonderful movie. Last great last shot of that film too, as he rolls the television out of the hotel room into the.
Yes, awesome. That was super good. And I will make a point of watching Bone Tomahawk. Everyone just keeps giving me endless shit about not
Just
seeing it.
leave me
God
alone.
damn
I'll watch this goddamn movie.
it. What? I'm watching it now. Leave me alone.
And someone was with like Patton Oswalt. They were like, "What scene are you talking about?" And Patton's like, "You know what scene I'm talking about. You know. And if you don't know, you'll know when it happens."
Oh,
So
that's right. Because Oswald does a whole routine on it, doesn't he? In one of
he
his
might.
specials?
He
No,
might.
I think he does.
Yeah.
Yeah. So okay. Yeah. Okay. I'll make a point of tonight when we're not watching baseball. I will try to find where I can watch Bone Tomahawk.
Yeah,
I promise.
speaking of horror shows, the Red Sox this season. Oi, anyway.
Well, Red Sox are out of it. Yankees are out of it. And now, I actually like Detroit, but Detroit's out of it. I'm a moderate Mariners fan. So Mariners onto the ALCS.
Yeah,
Mariners, Blue Jays. That'll be good.
let's get Mariners Blue Jays. That'll be good. And let's get Mariners Brewers in the World Series, two teams that have never won it. That I would like to see that a lot. Plus, it's the two old Seattle teams because Milwaukee Brewers
Oh,
were
that's
the
right.
Seattle Pilots before they moved out to the Midwest. So,
Yeah, and fuck the Dodgers. Hate the Dodgers. The Yankees of the West.
right,
Separately.
Brian, do we have a curse word of the week?
We do. Curse word of the week comes to us from, I feel bad using and abusing this country as much as I do. Going back to the country of Germany, the German word Backpfeifengeschicht. You know,
Backpfeifengeschicht.
you don't know German at all, do you?
This sounds awful lot like the word for when you want to slap somebody with the back of your hand or pop somebody in the face.
So the German word Backpfeifengeschicht is a tongue twister that literally translates to, quote, a face begging to be slapped. It's used to describe someone who deserves a slap or punch to the face. The word is made up of two parts, Backpfeife, slang for a face slap, and geschickt. This is the geschickt.
This area here in the face.
Yeah, above the chin, below the hairline. And it doesn't really translate directly into English, but it's used to describe people who you dislike or whose face annoys you, but it's not commonly used to describe someone you find unattractive. It's a punchable face, basically.
Okay. All right.
So it's not an ugly person, but it's just someone who is deserves the back of the hand, as you said.
Yeah, it's like the kind of person you see in the I got this from, I think, a Robert Rodriguez movie. His mama should have knocked him in the head and sold her milk.
Right. Yes,
Yeah.
very much. So thank you. Thank you, Deutschland, again.
It just keeps giving, doesn't it? The German language. It's wonderful.
Right. All right. So this story I was going to cover a while ago, and I've been on my list for a while. And then this story, something tells me you probably have heard of this at least. I read a book about this topic many moons ago. And feel free to raise your hand if you know what I'm talking about. It'll
Okay.
be obvious fairly quickly, I think. It began with rain, cold, relentless, ceaseless rain that fell for days over the Allegheny Mountains of western Pennsylvania. By May 30th, 1889, the sky above the Conemaugh Valley had turned to iron. The creeks were swollen, the rivers restless, and the people of Johnstown,
Oh, no. Okay.
a steel town tucked into the narrow folds of the valley, they were getting worried. But they had worried before. Every spring brought rain, and every spring rivers crept over their banks, flooding basements and flooding streets. The people were used to it. Flooding came and went, but life just trundled on. Johnstown in the 1880s was a thriving industrial town. It sat about 60 miles east of Pittsburgh, where the Conemaugh River met Stony Creek in a narrow valley hemmed in by steep hills. The town at the time was home to about 30,000 people, mostly steelworkers, iron workers, and their families. The Cambria Iron Works was the beating heart of the town, one of the largest steel producers in the nation. The town was proud, hardworking, close-knit. Immigrant families from Germany, Wales, various places all over Eastern Europe crowded into wooden houses that lined narrow streets. They worked long hours in mills and foundries. But for all the prosperity, Johnstown sat in a dangerous place. It basically sat in a basin. It was at the bottom of a bowl. The rivers that flowed through it could rise fast and didn't have any place to go. 20 miles upriver, high in the Alleghenies, the South Fork Dam had been built decades before. In the 1840s, it was a project of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, part of a massive public works system meant to connect Pittsburgh and Philly by both canal and rail. The dam created Lake Conemaugh, a reservoir 3 miles long and 1 mile wide, and its purpose was practical. It fed water into the western division of the Pennsylvania Canal system and ensured smooth passage for barges and goods across the state. At the time, it was definitely an impressive feat of engineering. It was an earthen dam that measured nearly 900 feet long, 70 feet high, and 450 feet thick at the base, built of clay, stone, and earth. It held back 20 million tons of water. And so when you picture this dam, you're not picturing Hoover Dam or like the Alamos Basin Dam here in San Antonio, which is basically a big concrete wall. It's basically a long, low berm that you could. I want to say the Canyon Lake Dam here in Central Texas kind of has it's buffeted on the backside by a long slope, because I've driven past that one and seen deer on the slope. So you could actually walk up the dam. So very, very, very similar here, long and low, but with a gentle incline. In the 1850s, when the Pennsylvania Railroad took over all the transport routes, the canal system was basically abandoned. So the dam is now. The dam and the lake are left to the wilderness, unattended and not maintained. In the 1870s, the dam suddenly had new owners, a group of wealthy folks from Pittsburgh. Henry Clay Frick, Andrew Mellon, Andrew Carnegie purchased this property and created a private mountain resort called the South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club. which I know you've heard of because it was covered on another podcast that you and I both listened to.
Yeah, it was also, I believe, the original title was The Piss on the Poor Hunting and Sporting Club.
Yes,
Just piss on him.
could well have been. So this, this lake is going to be their playground. The lake is stocked with fish, and they build cottages and a huge clubhouse. To make the lake even more picturesque, the caretakers altered the dam.
Yeah.
They lowered the crest by
Jesus
several feet
Christ.
to build a carriage road across the top. They removed and sold off the original cast iron drainage pipes at the bottom, replacing them with wooden ones. And to keep all the prized fish in the lake, they didn't want the fish escaping downstream. They installed a heavy wire screen across the spillway, which very easily clogged with debris. They're not engineers, and they didn't really want to consult with one because it was going to be expensive. And it was basically the dam's solid enough, the dam's fine. It's no, we have to worry about it. We're having fun smoking cigars and drinking brandy and being rich. So fuck
Who
you.
needs expertise on something as paltry as a dam holding back millions and millions of gallons of water? I mean, it's you people. You just those who can't
Divas.
dam those who can't dam teach. I mean, geez. Assholes.
So they had this lakefront paradise, but to the folks in Johnstown, the lake and the dam it's a shadow and it's a very clear threat. From time to time, someone would notice leaks in the dam's face, water seeping through the base. Again, it's not a concrete dam like most modern dams. It's made of dirt. And each time temporary repairs were made, stones were packed in, earth is tamped down, and the lake remains full. Throughout the 1880s, folks in Johnstown had grown very accustomed to rumors about the dam, and mill workers and townsfolk would just look up the valley and shake their head and say, if that thing ever goes, it's going to wipe us all off the map. A local engineer, a guy named John Park, he actually worked for the South Fork Club, was worried too, because this guy apparently had some level of decency. He had written warnings about the dam's condition, about the lowered crest and the blocked spillway, and he could see what was coming, and he was really worried that a major storm would just be too much. But again, repairs were going to be expensive, even though they could afford it. Again, they just assumed it's fine. It's fine. What could possibly go wrong? Even if it does go wrong, it's not really going to impact us. So it's fine. In the final days of May 1889, a huge storm sweeps eastward across the Midwest and into Pennsylvania. It brought torrents of rain, unlike the region had ever seen. This is a region that's accustomed to a lot of rain. By May 30th, the rivers around Johnstown were all dangerously high. The Conemaugh was swollen, muddy water churning through the valley. It was constant water. Bridges are underwater. Streets had were basically became streams. Up at the South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club, caretakers there were, their worry was getting worse. The lake is rising fast. The spillway was definitely clogged with branches, logs, and
Located over
fencing.
12 hours of pain relief with Dr. Scholl Pain Relief.
Sorry, phone
What
went
the
off. Phone went off, sorry.
The spillway is not functioning, and the dam's face, if you ever walked across a waterlogged yard when it's just saturated and it's like walking on a sponge, it's just kind of you're almost surfing on it. The dam's face is saturated and just rivulets of water is just flowing out of the face of the dam. That night, Park sends messages down to the valley via telegraph. The dam was in danger and the water is rising. In Johnstown, telegraph operators received the warnings, but by then, flood messages were common. Every storm brought one, and again, they didn't really pay that much attention. We know it's raining, duh. But at dawn on the next day, May 31st, 1889, the rain still hadn't stopped. Sheets of water pushed pouring down, whole trees being carried away by floodwaters. At the dam, workers there tried everything they could. They actually rowed out onto, I mentioned earlier, they'd lowered it and then built a road across the top of it. They rowed out on the top of the dam. Just imagine that. Okay, Morris, go out to the top of that dam and poke it. well, because we think this is, no, you poke it. I'm not doing that. They went out with shovels and axes and whatever they could, trying to clear the spillway. They also tried to dig new channels to relieve the pressure. They even attempted to raise the dam's crest with sandbags and with clay. But the water just keeps
That
rising.
doesn't, but that doesn't help the pressure on what's below
Right.
it.
Right.
And wasn't this carriage road, was that built so they wouldn't have to go all the way around? They could cut to one side of the
Correct.
club to the other without going all through the woods and around the back and just
Correct.
assholes.
So by mid-morning, water is now spilling over the top of the dam. John Park sends another telegram down to the town. South Fork Dam is liable to break. Stop. Notify the people below to prepare for the worst. Stop. The message reached Johnstown, but the telegraph lines were failing and some were now down. Floodwaters, again, already filling the streets. This is before, any serious flood. And few believe the dam could really fail. It'd been there for 40 years, the 50 years at this point. It was too old. It was too solid. It was 900 feet across. It's going to be fine. At 1:10 p.m. on May 31st, the water is, inches from the top. And then, as these caretakers are there watching it, there's this long, low groan, and they can see that the dam is starting to move.
Oh, and it's not supposed to do that,
That's I'm no expert.
right?
I'm not a civil engineer. It starts to move and it's making a sound, but it doesn't go immediately. It does that for about 90 minutes. At 3:10 p.m. on May 31st, the dam just goes. It completely gives way in an instant. The entire face of the dam collapses and releases 14 million cubic meters of water. Which is more than the volume of Niagara Falls. So if you've ever been to, and I've stood at the corner of Niagara Falls right there on the Canadian side and watched that. And I've been surfing, not surfing, canoeing and tubing in Central Texas, and there's some nice little fast water and stuff. Watching Niagara Falls up close, I was remember being blown away by the speed at which the water is going and how just deafeningly loud it was. It's just you can't talk. It's just being standing next to a jet engine.
And everything near it, even if you're on the Canadian, well, the Canadian sides where you see the best stuff, you're moist. You are moist all the time
Right. There's
because there's
right. There's
water in the
just
air
right.
constantly.
Right. Yeah. 300% humidity, just spraying you in the face. So a wall of water, 40 feet high and nearly a half a mile wide,
God
tears
bless.
down the valley, picking up everything in its path. Trees, houses, animals, locomotives, entire farms are just whoop, just wiped away. It moved at 40 miles an hour, faster than anyone could obviously run. It devoured the little towns of South Fork, Mineral Point, and East Conemaugh in minutes. Witnesses said it looked like a black wall higher than the treetops, filled with smoke and debris just coming down. In some places, the flood carried whole locomotives for miles. A train engineer, seeing the wave approaching, tried to race ahead to warn Johnstown, but the flood overtook him, overtook the train as he was on the tracks, heading south, heading down. Down in Johnstown, the rain had finally begun to ease, and people were waiting around in, knee-deep water, trying to salvage furniture and grab livestock and where are my kids and just the insanity that would ensue when you have knee-deep water. And then there is this sort of sound that sounds like thunder, but it doesn't stop. There's growing sound of thunder, getting closer and closer, and then just an explosion of water. The wave hits Johnstown at 4:07 p.m. For more than an hour after the dam broke, the flood had been roaring down the valley, a rolling mountain of mud and timber and shattered homes. By the time it reaches Johnstown, it's still 35 feet high. There's no time to flee. First thing people noticed was the sound, a hollow thunder that echoed off the hills. When the ground would shake, windows rattled, horses panicked and fled. And then this wall just was on them in seconds. Whole blocks of the town vanished in a moment. Wooden houses splintered like matchsticks, trains were ripped from their tracks and hurled through the air. Families were swept away before they could reach higher ground. A church steeple crashed through the roof of a neighboring row house. A locomotive smashed through a stone bridge, and the air was filled with crashing timbers, the roar of water, and people screaming. In some places, the wave reached nearly 60 feet high. It tore through the middle of town, following the line of the river. It hit the Cambria Iron Works, and it hit it like a bomb. The mill collapsed. Furnaces were tore open. Iron railings twisted like they were nothing, like they were not even there. The Conemaugh Viaduct is a massive stone railroad bridge just upstream, just on the upstream side of town. And it was the first, it was one of the few structures that actually withstood the initial impact, initial wall of water. But that soon made things worse. As the flood swept through town, all of the debris, miles of it, piled up against that bridge because the bridge basically formed a dam. So you would steal the remains of homes and factories and wagons and trains and dead animals and now hundreds of dead bodies.
Thousands of tons of crap just slapped up against that.
Tangled in this gigantic mass. So the debris slams tightly against the arches of this aqueduct, forms a mound of 30 feet high of just shit, just detritus, of just stuff. The water starts to go down, but somewhere within that pile, in all this mess, there's also oil lamps and kerosene and gasoline from overturned locomotives.
I thought you were going to say bees.
Sharks.
And boy, were they pissed.
So all of this flammable material catches light in spite of all the water. And now this wall of debris is now on fire.
And now it's a Randy Newman song.
Flames spread across the mass, trapping hundreds of people still alive in the wreckage. Witnesses heard screams for hours, men, women, and children. But you couldn't reach them because they were somewhere in this tangled mass of debris that's now a roaring fire. When the fire finally burns out, there are more than 80 bodies that were found that had burned to death in the blaze, some of which were never identified. But there were some survivors. One was Gertrude Quinn Slattery. She was 6 years old. She had been swept from her home and later recalled being carried through the flood, clinging to a piece of roof. She saw trees, fences, houses swirling past. Finally, she got pulled from the water by a man on horseback, one of the hundreds of rescuers that saved lives that day. Another was Victor Heiser, a young man. He had run for higher ground just before the wave struck. He watched from a hillside as his family's home was crushed and carried away. His parents were killed. Years later, Heiser became a doctor and a world-renowned public health official, but he was always haunted by that day for the rest of his
life.
I can't
imagine.
There was Annie Conrad, who clung to a floating section of her house as it spun like a top through the streets. She said later, it was like the end of the world, the sky black with rain and smoke and the river filled with fire. When the water finally settled, the valley was completely unrecognizable. A town of 30,000 people had been erased. 4 square miles of Johnstown were gone. 2,200 people were dead. One in three bodies was never identified. It was the deadliest disaster in the U.S. to that date, second only to the Civil War in terms of loss of life. Everywhere you look, there is devastation. Streets buried in mud, debris 10 feet deep, dead animals, shattered carriages tangled in trees, bodies found miles downstream. Rescue efforts began immediately. Those who had survived, many injured and half drowned, started digging out through the wreckage for family and for neighbors. And they used axes, crowbars, bare hands, whatever they could find to start trying to rebuild their life. Among the first to reach Johnstown was the U.S. Army's 14th Infantry Regiment and the Pennsylvania National Guard. Clara Barton comes to the area, and this is one of the first major relief efforts she's involved in. As I think she actually founds the American Red Cross in this period of time. She and her volunteers arrived there within days, setting up tents, handing out food and medicine, and the Red Cross was there for months and months afterwards, just trying to rebuild this town, setting up shelters and hospitals and schools. And so, you know, that's why she is lauded for her humanitarian efforts. The scale of the grief is just, you know, beyond comprehension, because families are wiped out completely, bodies found miles away, some people never found at all. They're just gone completely. A mother named Maggie Gallagher lost all five of her children.
Oh, Jesus.
A steel worker named John Hess found his wife's body 2 days later after the flood, but his son's body wasn't found until 3 weeks later, 20 miles
Oh,
downstream.
God.
Survivors were haunted by the sounds from that day, the screams, the roar of water, and the eerie silence afterwards. For decades after this event, no one in Johnstown could bear the sound of rain because it was just a
Yeah.
PTSD
Oh,
response.
yeah.
So, also, you know, the question is, you know, is brought up afterwards, whose fault is this? So, they start pointing at the South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club. Engineers who examined the remains of the dam found it was obviously, as I already said, badly maintained, weakened by these crappy ass modifications that they did to it, lowering the crest, yanking out the drainage pipes, etc. Experts testified that if the dam had been built and maintained, it would have held and the flood would never have happened. The public, of course, is outraged. Newspapers all over the country are condemning the Carnegies, the Fricks, and the Mellons, and editorials called the flood a crime against the people. But, you know, they made several folks made survivors made attempts in filing lawsuits, but no member of the club ever pays a dime. It's deemed an act of God and just an unavoidable natural disaster, and fuck you, you're poor. So, basically,
And by God, we mean Andrew Carnegie.
right. So, you know, no family ever got a cent. The victims of Johnstown buried their dead, rebuilt their homes, got no compensation. Something definitely changed in the wake of that failure. The idea that, you know, the public, that wealthy and powerful could hide behind legal shields began to crumble. That outrage did push for stronger engineering standards going forward. And so, you know, into the 20th century, there was a trend toward liability laws that would actually help victims, you know, in these cases. By the end of that year, just the fall of the same year, Johnstown is coming up out of the mud. Red Cross is still there. By the end of the year, trains are running again. The sound of hammers and saws filled the valley, and they, you know, they were probably fully recovered, but within a year they were relatively back to normal. Today, the Johnstown Flood National Memorial stands where the South Fork Dam once stood, and you can go there and look out over the quiet valley and imagine the moment when that dam gave way. And that's the story of the Johnstown Flood.
Jesus, that's, you know, funny thing about valleys, they're natural chutes for stuff, fire, water, avalanches. I mean, my pa died in the flood. How did he die? He burned to death. I mean, just
Right.
fucked up.
Yeah,
Where do you, what?
the just the power of water. I mean, my father passed away well before Katrina, but I remember, but he was an engineer. Remember thinking, you know, it seems, you know, the wisdom of building a city below sea level. The wisdom of building a town right below a dam. You know, just the forces here are beyond conception, really, especially, you know, 150 years ago. And so I don't know. So it's, but again, you know, yet again, a story where the wealthy go, meh, you know, it sounds expensive. And, you know, so I don't want to do that.
Where did you first hear about the Johnstown flood? Do you remember
Well,
that, your
the
friend?
main source, I mean, I read the David McCullough book on this, just called The Johnstown Flood, that came out. I've had that book for decades. So great book. And not some of McCullough's work is pretty dense. This one's not that dense, but a super interesting book. And just, the further hell of there being water than also fire, just insane, but interesting story.
I first learned about it through one of the great storytellers of our time. His 1982 album Nebraska, Mr. Bruce Springsteen,
Oh, wow.
references the Johnstown flood. Me and Frankie laughing and drinking, nothing feels better than blood on blood. We took turns at dancing with Maria while the band played the night of the Johnstown flood. And that's the first time I heard of it. I was like, what was that about? And yeah, just a incomprehensibly tragic and avoidable. I mean, I think if they
Completely
hadn't messed, I
avoidable.
think if they hadn't messed with the drainage system, things might have been okay. I think putting that wire grate up is really what, I mean, just,
We want to fish. Our fish are gonna get
yeah.
out, right? Right. Yeah, I don't know. There actually are, if you go online and Google this, there actually are, and it was recent enough where photography existed. So photos of it are unbelievable. Just the piles of trees and piles of debris, just staggering.
Oh, I can't imagine. There was a there's a documentary on an avalanche that hit a ski resort, and just the before and after pics are, and that was I think the 80s, and it's just, have respect for the game, man, and the game is nature, and nature will.
Right. We are not in charge.
No, and it's beyond me when people get out there and find themselves in situations where it's like, well, this is not a theme park. This is the river doesn't care. I mean, it's just
Right.
the mountain definitely doesn't care.
Right. You are in the way.
Well,
So,
that was a nice horror-themed
yeah, sort of. Oh,
yeah,
yeah, we kind of had
horror the
some kismet
horror
there, a tiny bit.
oh God, a horror movie set in like, oh, that'd be, ooh. Like there's a serial killer, somebody kicking around Johnstown and right before the flood, and you don't know how many people died in the flood and how many died because of the serial killer or the demon or no one do that.
Right.
Anyway, yeah, the horrors of movies and the horror of unbridled, unregulated capitalism. Isn't it wonderful?
Thanks for listening, folks. We appreciate it. Please like, share, subscribe our stuff. Check out dreamidiots.com. And not sure what else to say. We appreciate you hanging in there with us. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, enjoy October, enjoy the Halloween season, and try to see some scary movies. Take care of each other.
This is a Rough Tiger production.
Bong bong, Brian.
Bong bong?
Bong bong.
Bong bong. Good.